Meg Whyn Owen and Patrick Allen in the fourth episode of Jane Eyre, adapted by Barbara Cooper from the novel by Charlotte Bronte. It was late afternoon when Jane Eyre, weary and sick at heart, at last lifted her head from her arms. Since early that morning, after the return from church, and after witnessing the terrible scene between Mr. Rochester and his mad wife, she had lain silent and motionless. That she was not Edward Rochester's bride was the least part of her woe. But that she must now leave him, leave Thornfield, instantly and entirely, that thought was intolerable, a horror which she could neither bear nor master.
My head swam as I stood erect, and I remembered that neither meat nor drink had passed my lips that day, for I had taken no breakfast. And with a strange pang, I now reflected that long as I had been shut up in my room, no message had been sent to ask how I was. Not even little Adele had tapped at the door. Not even Mrs. Fairfax had sought me. I undrew the bolt and passed through, stumbling over an obstacle. My head was still dizzy and my limbs were feeble. I could not recover myself and fell. An outstretched arm caught me. I looked up. I was supported by Mr. Rochester, who sat in a chair across my chamber threshold.
You have come out at last. I've been waiting for you long. Not one movement have I heard, not one sob. 5 minutes more of that death-like hush and I should have forced the lock. Well, Jan, not a word of reproach. Nothing bitter, nothing poignant. You sit quietly where I placed you and regard me with a weary, passive look. Jan, I never meant to wound you thus. Will you ever forgive me? You know I am a scoundrel, Jane.
Yes, sir.
Then tell me, roundly and sharply. Don't spare me.
I cannot. I'm tired, sick. I want some water.
Why did I not think of that? No. No, you're not fit to stand. I will carry you down. There, Jane. Rest there a while.
I shall be well soon, sir.
Jane, try and sip a little of this wine. That's better. Eat this if you can.
Thank you, sir.
You're as cold as ice. Eat a little more while I attend to the fire. How are you now, Jane?
Much better, sir.
Taste the wine again. Ah, the color begins to return to your cheeks. Oh, Jane.
No, sir.
What? How is this? Oh, I know. You won't kiss the husband of Bertha Mason.
There is neither room nor claim for me, sir.
Because I have a wife already.
Yes.
So you intend to make yourself a complete stranger to me. To live under this roof only as Adele's governess. If ever I say a friendly word to you, if ever a friendly feeling inclines you again to me, you will say, that man had nearly made me his mistress. I must be ice and rock to him. And ice and rock you will accordingly become.
All is changed about me, sir. I must change too. There is no doubt of that. Adele must have a new governess, sir.
Oh, Adele will go to school. I have settled that already. Jane, you shall not stay here, nor will I. I'll shut up Thornfield Hall. I'll nail up the front door and board the lower windows. I'll give Mrs. Poole 200 a year to live here with my wife, as you term that fearful hag.
You speak of her with hate.
It is cruel. She cannot help being mad.
Jane, my little darling, if you were mad, do you think I should hate you?
I do indeed, sir.
Then you are mistaken, and you know nothing about me. Every atom of your flesh is as dear to me as my own. In pain and sickness, it would still be dear. Jane, I only ask you to endure one more night under this roof. I have a place to repair to which will be...
Take Adele with you, sir. She will be a companion for you.
What do you mean? I told you I would send Adele to school.
You spoke of retirement, sir. And retirement and solitude are dull. Too dull for you.
Solitude? Solitude? You are to share my solitude, do you understand?
No, sir.
Ah, now for the hitch in Jane's character. The reel of silk has run smoothly enough so far, but I always knew there would come a knot and a puzzle. Here it is. Now for vexation and exasperation and endless trouble. Oh, by God, I long to exert a fraction of Samson's strength and break the entanglement like tow. Jane, will you hear reason? Because if you won't, I'll try violence.
Sir, sit down. I'll talk to you as long as you like and hear all you have to say, whether reasonable or unreasonable.
Jane, I entreat you, compose yourself. Hush now. Wipe your eyes.
I cannot while you're in such a passion.
Oh, but I am not angry, Jane. I only love you too well. You had steeled your little pale face with such a resolute, frozen look. I could not endure it. There. Rest your head on my shoulder.
No. Let me go, sir.
Oh, Jane, Jane, you don't love me, then.
I do love you. More than ever. But this is the last time I must express it. I must leave you.
For how long, Jane? For a few minutes while you smooth your hair, which is somewhat disheveled, and bathe your face, which looks feverish.
For my whole life, I must begin a new existence.
Of course, I told you you should. You shall go to a place I have in the south of France. Why do you shake your head? Jane, you must be reasonable, or in truth I shall again become frantic.
Sir, your wife is living.
Jane, I am not a gentle-tempered man. You forget this. Out of pity for me and yourself, put your finger on my pulse. Feel how it throbs. And beware.
Oh, God, help me.
Oh, I am a fool. I have not explained. Just put your hand in mine, Jane, and I will in a few words show you the real state of the case. Can you listen to me?
Yes, sir. For hours, if you will.
I ask only minutes. Jane, my father was an avaricious, grasping man. And he was resolved that I must be provided for by a wealthy marriage. When I left college, I was sent out to Jamaica to espouse a bride already courted for me. My father said nothing about her money. But he told me Miss Mason was the boast of Spanish town for her beauty. This was no lie. I married her. I never loved, I never esteemed, I did not even know her. My bride's mother I had never seen. I understood she was dead. The honeymoon over, I learned my mistake. She was only mad and shut up in a lunatic asylum. There was a younger brother, too, a complete dumb idiot. Richard Mason, the elder brother you know. My father knew all this, but thought only of the money. Jane, I lived with that woman upstairs 4 years. Her character ripened and developed with frightful rapidity. Her vices sprang up fast and rank. The doctors now discovered that my wife was mad. Her excesses had prematurely developed the germ of insanity. Jane, you don't like my narrative. You look almost sick. Shall I defer the rest to another day?
No, sir. Finish now. I pity you. I do earnestly pity you.
Pity, Jane, from some people is a noxious and insulting sort of tribute, but that is not your pity. I accept your pity, my darling.
What did you do when you found she was mad?
Jane, I approach the verge of despair. This life, said I, at last is hell. I have a right to deliver myself from it if I can. Let me break away and go home to God. I meant to shoot myself. But I only entertained the intention for a moment, for then I framed and fixed on resolution. Go, said Hope, and live again in Europe. There it is not known what filthy burden is bound to you. Take the maniac to England, confine her with due attendance. Then travel yourself to what clime you will and form what new tie you like. To England, then, I conveyed her. And at last hired Grace Poole. She and the surgeon Carter are the only two I have ever admitted to my confidence. A Mrs. Fairfax may indeed have suspected something, but she could have gained no precise knowledge of the facts. When I think of the thing which flew at my throat this morning, I thank Providence who watched over you that she spent her fury on your wedding apparel.
And what, sir, did you do when you settled here? Where did you go?
When you are inquisitive, Jane, you always make me smile. You open your eyes like an eager bird and make every now and then a restless movement as if answers and speech did not flow fast enough.
Well, sir?
Well, for 10 long years I roved about, living first in one capital and another. Yet I could not live alone. So I tried the companionship of mistresses.
Oh.
The first I chose was Celine Daron. You already know that she was Adele's mother. But Jane, I see by your face you're not forming a very favorable opinion of me just now.
I don't like you so well as I have done sometimes, indeed, sir. Did it not seem to you the least wrong to live in that way? First with one mistress and then another? You talk of it as a mere matter of course.
It was with me, and I did not like it. I should never like to return to it. Now, Jane, why don't you say, well, sir? You are looking grave. You disapprove of me still, I see. But let me come to the point. Recalled by business, I came back to England. On a frosty winter afternoon, I rode in sight of Thornfield Hall. On a stile in Hay Lane, I saw a quiet little figure sitting by itself. I was surly, but the thing would not go. It stood by me with a strange perseverance and looked and spoke with a sort of authority. It seemed as if a linnet had hopped to my foot and proposed to bear me on its tiny wing. I heard you come home that night, Jane. In the weeks following, I used to enjoy a chance meeting with you. There was a curious hesitation in your manner. He glanced at me with slight trouble. I had much ado often to avoid straining you then and there to my heart.
Don't talk any more of those days.
No, Jane. What necessity is there to dwell on the past when the present is so much surer, the future so much brighter? Why are you silent? Jane, you understand what I want of you. Just this promise. I will be yours, Mr. Rochester.
Mr. Rochester, I will not be yours.
Jane, do you mean to go one way in the world and let me go another?
I do.
Oh, Jane, let me hold you in my arms. Oh, do you mean it now?
I do.
And now, with my lips upon your cheek.
I do.
Oh, Jane, it would not be wicked to love me.
It would to obey you.
One instant, Jane. Give one glance to my horrible life when you are gone. All happiness will be torn away with you. What shall I do? Where turn for a companion and for some hope?
Do as I do. Trust in God and yourself. Believe in heaven. Hope to meet again there.
Then you will not yield.
No.
Wait. You snatch love and innocence from me. You fling me back on lust for a passion, vice for an occupation.
I no more assign this fate to you than I grasp at it for myself. We were born to strive and endure, you as well as I. Do so. You will forget me before I forget you.
You make me a liar by such language. I declared I could not change. You tell me to my face I shall change soon. Change.
No, sir. No. Let me go. Oh,
never. Never was anything at once so frail and so indomitable. A mere reed she feels in my hand. I could bend her with my finger and thumb. And what good would it do if I bent, if I uptore, if I crushed her? Oh, come, Jane, come, come.
I am going, sir.
You are leaving me?
Yes.
Then my deep love, my frantic prayers are all nothing to you.
I am going.
Oh, Jane. My hope.
God bless you, my dear master. God keep you from harm and wrong.
During the night I rose. I was dressed, for I had taken off nothing but my shoes. I made up a parcel of linen. My purse containing 20 shillings I put in my pocket, and then I stole from my room. Farewell, kind Mrs. Fairfax. Farewell, my darling Adele. A mile off beyond the field lay a road which stretched in the contrary direction to Millcote. Thither I bent my steps. I skirted fields and hedges and lanes till after sunrise. My shoes were soon wet with dew. I was weeping wildly as I walked along. Fast, fast I went like one delirious. A weakness seized me and I fell. I lay on the ground some minutes, pressing my face to the wet turf. I had some fear or hope that here I should die. But I was soon up, crawling forwards on my hands and knees, and then again raised to my feet. When I reached the road, I heard wheels and saw a coach coming.
And what may you be wanting, ma'am?
In what direction are you going?
A goodish space from these parts. South, passing through Whitcourt.
For what sum will you take me there?
Cost you a matter of 30 shillings.
I have but 20, and I can walk no further.
We'll see if we can make and do. I'm not overburdened with passengers.
Oh, thank you. I am indeed grateful.
Please to get inside then, ma'am. Where you'll find out for company but yourself. Come on in.
Two days later, the coachman set me down at Whitcross. I was not possessed of another shilling in the world. And at that moment I discovered that I had forgotten to take my parcel out of the pocket of the coach where I'd placed it for safety. I was alone and absolutely destitute. The next day, want came to me, pale and bare. At 2 in the afternoon, I entered a village, and there was a little shop with some cakes of bread in the window. Had I nothing I could offer in exchange for one of these rolls? I felt I must try, and entered the shop.
Good afternoon, Mum. What may I serve you with?
I was wondering. That is, have I your permission to sit here for a few moments? I'm very tired.
Oh. Yes, very well. Over there.
Thank you. Could you inform me if there's a dressmaker or plain workwoman in the village?
Yes, 2 or 3. Quite as many as there's employment for.
Do you know of any place in the neighbourhood where a servant is wanted?
Nay, I couldn't say.
Would you?
Yes.
Would you give me a roll for this handkerchief?
What's that? Nay, I never sell stuff in that way.
Then half a cake.
How can I tell where you got the handkerchief?
Will you take my gloves?
Nay. What can I do with them?
Yes.
Is this the parsonage?
Yes.
The clergyman in?
No.
Will he be in soon?
No, he's gone from home.
Is there any lady of the house?
Nay, there's nought but me, and I'm the housekeeper. What is it you want?
Well, it is of no consequence. Thank you.
I had strayed far, and my strength was failing me. My glazed eye wandered over the dim and misty landscape, when at one point, far in among the marshes and the ridges, a light sprang up. I tried to walk again. I fell twice, but as often I rose and rallied my faculty. This light was my forlorn hope. I must gain it. A whitish object gleamed before me. It was a gate. Entering and seeking the door, I turned an angle. There shot out the friendly gleam again from the lozenged panes of a very small latticed window. I could see clearly a room with a sanded floor clean scoured, a dresser of walnut with pewter plates. An elderly woman, somewhat rough-looking, was knitting a stocking. Two young, graceful women, ladies in every point, sat, one in a low rocking chair, the other on a lower stool. Both wore deep mourning. So hushed was the firelit apartment, I could hear the cinders fall from the grate, the clock tick in its obscure corner.
I wonder when St. John will come home. Anna, will you have the goodness to look at the fire in the parlour?
I will, children. Eh, but Mary, it fair troubles me to go into your room now. It looks so lonesome with chair empty and set back in corner. It is in a better place, and then nobody need to have had a quieter death nor he had.
You say he never mentioned us, Hannah?
He hadn't time, bairn. He was gone in a minute with your father.
I wonder all was St. John did not...
No, dearie, no blame to your brother. When Mr. St. John asked your father if you would like either of you to be sent for, he fair laughed at him. He thought he was only a bit ailing, as we all did. Eh, children, that's last of the old stock. Your mother were a picture of you, Mary. Diana's more like your father. Well, you'll be wanting your supper, I'm sure, and so will your brother when he comes in. He's late, and what a night to be abroad. Now, who can that be knocking? What do you want?
May I speak to your mistresses?
Hey, you'd better tell me what you have to say to them. Where'd you come from?
I'm a stranger.
Well, what's your business here at this hour?
I want a night's shelter. In an outhouse or anywhere. And a morsel of bread to eat.
I'll give you a piece of bread, but we can't take in vagrant to lodge. It isn't like that.
Would you let me speak to your mistresses?
Nay, not I. What can they do for you? You seem to be roving about now. It looks very ill.
But where will I go if you drive me away? What should I do? Tell the young ladies. Oh, let me see them.
Indeed I will not. You're not what you ought to be or you wouldn't make such a noise. Now move on.
But I'll just die if I'm dragged away.
Not you. I'm afeard you have some ill plans against that bring you about folk houses at this time of night.
Oh, I can't but die. I believe in God. Let me try to wait his will in silence.
All men must die. But all are not condemned to meet a lingering and premature doom such as yours would be if you perished here of want.
Oh, what speak?
Hannah!
Did you, Mr. Sheldon?
Yes, open quickly.
Oh, well, how wet and cold you must be, such a wild night as it is. I believe there are some bad folks about. There's been a... I declare she's not gone yet. Get up, for shame. Move off, I say.
Hush, Hannah. I have a word to say to the woman. You have done your duty in excluding. Now let me do mine in admitting her. I think this is a peculiar case. I must at least examine it. Young woman, rise and pass before me into the house. Diana! Mary!
Yes, St. John? We have been expecting you for some time and had quite... What's the matter, brother? St. John, who is it? What has happened?
I cannot tell. I found her at the door.
Oh, quickly, bring her to the chair, Hannah, or she'll fall. Is she ill or only famished, Diana? Famished, I think. Hannah, is that milk? Give it me. And a piece of bread. Now, try to eat. Yes, try. Poor thing. Her clothes, quite sodden. Try a little more. It would do you good.
Not too much at first. Restrain her. Give the cup to me. She has had enough, Diana.
Oh, a little more, St. John. Look at the hunger in her eyes.
No more at present, sister. Try if she can speak now. Ask her name.
My name is Jane Elliot.
And where do you live? Where are your friends?
Can we send for anyone you know?
What account can you give of yourself?
I can give you no details tonight.
But what then do you expect me to do for you?
Nothing.
Do you mean that we have now given you what aid you require, and that we may dismiss you to the moor in the rainy night?
I will trust you.
Hannah, let us sit there at present and ask no questions. In 10 minutes more, give her the remainder of that milk and bread. Mary, Diana, let us go into the parlor and talk the matter over.
They withdrew. A kind of pleasant stupor was stealing over me as I sat by the genial fire. Some directions were given to Hannah in an undertone. Ere long, with the servant's aid, I contrived to mount a staircase. My dripping clothes were removed. Soon a warm, dry bed received me. I thanked God and slept.
It is very well we took her in, Mary.
Yes, she would certainly have been found dead in the morning.
She is not an uneducated person, I should think, by her manner of speaking. She has a peculiar face. Fleshless and haggard as it is, I rather like it.
Mm.
Quietly, St. John. I think she sleeps. St. John, do you not think we should send for a doctor?
There is no disease. I do not think it is necessary. Every nerve has been overstrained in some way. I imagine her recovery will be rapid enough when once commenced. Rather an unusual physiognomy. Certainly not indicative of vulgarity or degradation. You will find she is some young lady who has had a misunderstanding with her friends. She is not at all handsome.
She is so ill, St. John.
Ill or well, she will always be plain. The grace and harmony of beauty are quite wanting in those features.
What? Oh, you've got up. You're better, then. You may sit down in my chair in the hearthstone, if you will.
Thank you, Hannah.
I'll be getting on with my baking. Did you ever go a-begging afore you came here?
I'm no beggar. Any more than yourself or your young lady.
Oh, I don't understand that. You've like no house, no brass, I guess. Are you book learned?
Yes, very.
But you've never been to a boarding school?
I was at a boarding school 8 years.
Oh, whatever cannot you keep yourself for, then?
I have kept myself. And I trust you'll keep myself again.
Haven't you been a dressmaker?
No, you're wrong. Never mind what I have been. Don't trouble your head further about me, but tell me the name of the house where we are.
Some calls it Marsh End and some calls it Moor House.
And the gentleman who lives here is called Mr. St. John.
Nay, he's only staying a while with his sisters. When he's at home, he's in his parish at Morton.
And what is he?
He's a parson. Old Mr. Rivers, his father, lived here.
The name, then, of that gentleman is Mr. St. John Rivers.
Aye. And the three poor bairns have just lost their father. Dead 3 weeks then of a stroke.
They have no mother.
Mistress has been dead this many a year.
Have you lived with the family long?
I've lived here 30 years. I nursed them all three.
That proves you must have been an honest and faithful servant. I will say so much for you, though you've had the incivility to call me a beggar.
I believe I was quite mistaken in my thoughts of you. But there's so many cheats goes about. You mustn't think too hardly of me.
But I do think hardly of you. And I tell you why. Not so much because you refused to give me shelter, as because you just now made it a species of reproach that I had no brass and no house. If you are a Christian, you ought not to consider poverty a crime.
No more I hope, Mr. St. John tells me so too. And I see I were wrong, but I've a clear different notion on you now to what I had. You look a right decent little creature.
That will do. I forgive you now. Shake hands.
That I will, a flower on them and all.
Yes, Mary, it's been a wonderful day.
And here are my bairns back from their walk and ready for tea.
We've had such a pleasant walk, Hannah. The air is so invigorating.
The young lady has come down.
Oh, I'm so pleased you found yourself well enough to do so.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Oh, you still look very pale. Oh, and so thin. Oh, poor child.
And what business have you here? It is not your place. Mary and I sit in the kitchen sometimes, because at home we like to be free. But you are a visitor, and must go into the parlour.
Oh, I am very well here.
Not at all, with Hannah bustling about and covering you with flour.
Besides, the fire is too hot for you.
To be sure. Now come now to the inner room.
Oh, there. Give me your hand. You must be obedient.
I sit there with St. John while I bring the tea in.
I am coming with it, Diana. Hannah has prepared everything.
Ah, she's made some of her little cakes. Oh, eat one at once, my dear, and then we'll pour you out a cup of tea. Hannah says you've had nothing but some gruel since breakfast.
Thank you. Oh, delicious.
You are very hungry.
I am, sir.
It is well for you that a low fever has forced you to abstain for the last 3 days. There would have been danger in yielding to the cravings of your appetite at first.
I trust I shall not eat long at your expense, sir.
No. When you have indicated to us the residence of your friends, we can write them and you may be restored to home.
That, I must plainly tell you, is out of my power to do. Being absolutely without home and friends.
Oh, you poor child.
Do you mean to say that you are completely isolated from every connection?
I do. Not a tie links me to any living thing. Not a claim do I possess to admittance under any roof in England.
A most singular position at your age. You have never been married. You are a spinster.
Oh, why, she can't be above 17 or 18 years old, St. John.
I'm near 19. But I'm not married, no. No.
Where did you last reside?
You are too inquisitive, St. John.
I ask you, where did you last reside?
The name of the place where and of the person with whom I lived is my secret.
Which, if you like, you have, in my opinion, a right to keep, both from St. John and every other questioner.
Yet if I know nothing about you or your history, I cannot help you. And you need help, do you not?
I need it, and I seek it. So far, sir, that some true philanthropist will put me in the way of getting work which I can do, and the remuneration for which will keep me.
I know not whether I am a true philanthropist, yet I am willing to aid you. Tell me what you have been accustomed to do and what you can do.
Mr. Rivers, you and your sisters have done me a great service, and I will tell you as much of my history as I can. I am an orphan, the daughter of a clergyman. I was brought up a dependent, educated in a charitable institution. I obtained a good situation and was happy. This place, I was obliged to leave 4 days before I came here. The reason of my departure I cannot and ought not to explain. It would be useless and dangerous, and would sound incredible. You, Mr. Rivers, took me under the shelter of your roof. I know all your sisters have done for me, and I owe to their spontaneous compassion as large a debt as to your charity.
Don't make her talk any more now, St. John. No, she must rest. Come to the sofa now, Miss Elliot. Miss Elliot?
Oh, yes, thank you.
You said your name was Jane Elliot.
I did say so. But it is not my real name, and when I hear it, it sounds strange to me.
Your real name you will not give?
No,
I fear discovery above all things.
You are quite right, I am sure. Now do, brother, let her be at peace a while.
You would wish, I see, to dispense as soon as maybe with my sister's compassion and, above all, with my charity. I am quite sensible of the distinction drawn, nor do I resent it. It is just. You desire to be independent of us.
I do. Show me how to seek work. Then let me go, if it be but to the meanest cottage. But till then, allow me to stay here. I dread another essay of the horrors of homeless destitution.
Indeed, you shall stay here.
Yes, you shall.
My sisters, you see, have a pleasure in keeping you. I feel more inclination to put you in the way of keeping yourself, and shall endeavor to do so. But observe, my sphere is narrow. My aid must be of the humblest sort.
I will be a dressmaker. I will be a plain workwoman. I will be a servant, a nurse girl, if I can do no better.
Right. If such is your spirit, I promise to aid you. In my own time and way.
The more I knew of the inmates of Moor House, the better I liked them. In a few days, I had so far recovered my health that I could sit up all day. I could join with Diana and Mary in all their occupations. I liked to read what they liked to read. What they enjoyed delighted me. Diana offered to teach me German, and I liked to learn. As to Mr. St. John, the intimacy which had arisen so naturally and rapidly between me and his sisters did not extend to him. He was comparatively seldom at home. Days passed like hours, and weeks like days. Diana and Mary were soon to leave Moor House and return to the far different life and scene which awaited them as governesses in a large, fashionable South of England city. One morning, I sought St. John in the parlour.
You have a question to ask me?
Yes. I wish to know whether you've heard of any service I can offer myself to undertake.
I found or devised something for you 3 weeks ago.
Oh.
But as you seem both useful and happy here, as my sisters had evidently become attached to you, I deemed it inexpedient to break in on your mutual comfort till their approaching departure from Moor House should render yours necessary.
What is the employment you had in view, Mr. Rivers?
If I help you, it must be as the blind man would help the lame. I am poor. I can offer you but a service of poverty and obscurity. You may even think it degrading, but I consider no service degrades which can better our race.
Do you explain?
I will. When I came to Morton 2 years ago, it had no school. I established one for boys. I mean now to open a second school for girls. I have hired a building for the purpose, with a cottage of 2 rooms attached for the mistress's house. Her salary will be £30 a year. Her house is already furnished, very simply, but sufficiently. By the kindness of a lady, Miss Rosamond Oliver, the only daughter of the sole rich man in my parish. Will you be this mistress? Well?
I thank you for the proposal, and I accept it with all my heart.
But you comprehend me. Your scholars will only be poor girls, cottagers' children. What will you do with your accomplishments? What with the largest portion of your mind, sentiments, tastes?
Save them till they are wanted.
You know what you undertake, then?
I do.
I will open a school, if you like, next week.
Very well. So be it. Why do you shake your head? What do you disapprove of, Mr. Rivers?
You will not stay in Morton long. No, no.
Why? What is your reason for saying so?
I read it in your eye.
I'm not ambitious.
What made you think of ambition? Who is ambitious? I know I am, but how did you find out?
I was speaking of myself.
Well, if you are not ambitious, you are...
What?
I was going to say impassioned. I mean that human affections and sympathies have a most powerful hold on you. I'm sure you cannot long be content to pass your leisure in solitude and to devote your working hours to monotonous labor wholly void of stimulus. Any more than I can be content to live here buried in morass, pent in with mountain, my nature that God gave me contravened, my faculties heaven bestowed, paralyzed, made useless.
Oh,
you hear how I contradict myself. I, who preached contentment with a humble lot, I, God's ordained minister, almost rave in my restlessness. It is hard work to turn the bent of nature, but that it may be done, I know from experience. A year ago, I was myself intensely miserable because I thought I'd made a mistake in entering the ministry. After a season of darkness and struggling, my powers heard a call from heaven to rise. God had an errand for me. And a missionary, therefore, I resolved to be.
Oh.
From that moment, my state of mind changed. Some affairs settled, a successor for Morton provided, and entanglement or two of the feelings broken through or cut asunder, and I leave Europe for the East. Well, I've spoken enough. I have my morning study to attend to, and...
And you work a great deal too hard, St. John.
Nonsense, Diana. That is foolish talk. Oh, yes, Hannah.
A letter, Mr. St. John.
Oh, thank you. I will come to it.
He will sacrifice all to his long-framed resolves. You would think him gentle. Yet in some things he is inexorable as death. He will not stay long at Morton, Jane. It is right, noble, Christian. Yet it breaks my heart.
Dinner is cooked for the most part and ready for packing, Dad.
Dear sister, you're crying.
Oh, forgive me, Mary. I am foolish.
No. I know well what troubles you. I feel the same. It will certainly be a different parting from any we have yet known. We are now without father. We shall soon be without home and brother.
Oh, Diana, Mary, my dear friend, I... Why, St. John, what is this?
This letter.
Well?
Our Uncle John is dead.
Dead?
Yes.
And what then?
What then, Diana? What then? Why, nothing. Read.
I see. Yes, I see, St. John. So we shall not benefit after all. Oh, Jane, you will think us hard-hearted human beings not to be more moved. But we have never seen or known this uncle. He was never married and had no near kindred but ourselves.
And one other person, not more closely related than we.
Yes, as Mary says, one other. And this letter informs us that he has bequeathed every penny to that other relation.
He had a right, of course, to do as he pleased. And at any rate, it makes us no worse off than we were before.
Amen, Mary. We can yet live.
Yes, Diana. We must be thankful for that. We can yet live.
My home, then, is a cottage. A little room with whitewashed walls and a sanded floor. It is evening. This morning, the village school opened. I had 20 scholars. But 3 of the number can read, none write or cipher. Mary and Diana are gone from Marsh End. And I feel desolate to a degree. Again and again in my dreams at night, I would meet Mr. Rochester, and the hope of passing a lifetime at his side would be renewed with all its first force and fire. Then I would recall where I was and how situated. I was surprised to find myself ere long weeping. I rose, went to my door, and looked at the sunset, and at the quiet fields before my cottage. Now I hid my eyes and leant my head against the stone frame of my little porch. Soon, a slight noise made me look up. Old Carlo, Mr. Rivers' dog, was pushing the gate with his nose.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Rivers. Please come in and sit down.
No, I cannot stay. I've only brought you a little parcel my sister's left for you. I think it contains a colour box, pencils and paper.
It is indeed a welcome gift.
Have you found your first day's work harder than you expected?
Oh, no. On the contrary, I think in time I shall get on with my scholars very well.
I hope you feel the content you express.
Good evening, Mr. Rivers. And good evening, old Carlo. Your dog is quicker to recognize his friends than you are, sir.
A lovely evening, Miss Oliver. But, late for you to be out alone.
Papa told me you had opened your school and that the new mistress was come.
This is she?
It is.
Do you think you shall like Morton, Miss Elliot?
I hope I shall. I have many inducements to do so.
Do you like your house?
Very much.
Have I furnished it nicely?
Very nicely indeed.
I shall come up and help you to teach sometimes. Oh, Mr. Rivers, I have been so gay. Last night, or rather this morning, I was dancing till 2 o'clock. You are very silent.
Oh, poor Carlo loves me. He's not stern and distant to his friends.
Papa says you never come to see us now. Will you return with me and visit him?
It is not a seasonable hour to intrude on, Mr. Oliver.
Oh, now, Mr. Rivers, do come.
Not tonight, Miss Rosamond. Not tonight.
Well, if you are so obstinate, I will leave you, for the dew begins to fall. Good evening.
Good evening.
Why, Mr. Rivers, you look... Are you well?
Quite well. Good night.
Rosamond Oliver kept her word in coming to visit me. She generally came at the hour when Mr. Rivers was engaged in giving his daily catechizing lesson. In spite of his Christian stoicism, when she went up and addressed him, and smiled gaily, even fondly, in his face, his hand would tremble and his eye burn. It was the 5th of November and a holiday. The translation of a few pages of German occupied an hour. Then I got my palette and pencils and fell to the more soothing, because easier, occupation of completing a miniature of Rosamond Oliver. The head was finished already. There was but the background to tint.
Mr. Rivers, how kind of you to call.
I am come to see how you are spending your holiday. You see, I mistrust you still. Though you have borne up wonderfully so far. And whose likeness does your pencil trace? Let me...
Take a chair, Mr. Rivers.
Thank you. I cannot stay.
Is this portrait like?
Like? Like whom? I did not observe it closely.
You did, Mr. Rivers.
A very graceful and correct drawing.
Yes, yes, I know all that. But who is it like?
Miss Oliver, I presume.
Of course.
Yes. Yes, it is like. The colour, light, expression are perfect. It smiles.
Would it comfort, or would it wound you to have a similar painting?
But I would like to have it, is certain. Whether it would be judicious or wise is another question.
As far as I can see, it would be wiser and more judicious if you were to take to yourself the original at once. You ought to marry her. She likes you, I am sure.
Does she like me?
Better than she likes anyone else.
It is very pleasant to hear this, very. Go on for a few more minutes. I will take out my watch and place it here on the table.
But what is the use of going on when you are probably preparing some iron blow of contradiction?
No, don't imagine such hard things. Fancy me yielding and melting as I am doing. I see myself with my bride, Rosamond Oliver. She's talking to me with her sweet voice, smiling at me with those coral lips. She is mine and I am hers.
Oh.
No, hush, hush. Say nothing. My heart is full of delight. My senses are entranced. Let the time I marked pass in peace. There. That little space was given to delirium and delusion. It is strange that while I love Rosamond Oliver so wildly, I know that she would not make me a good wife.
Strange indeed.
Rosamond a sufferer, a laborer, a female apostle. Rosamond a missionary's wife. No.
But you do not need to be a missionary. You might relinquish that scheme.
Relinquish? What, my vocation, my great work?
And Miss Oliver?
She will forget me.
Oh, you speak coolly enough. But you suffer in the conflict. You are wasting away.
No. If I get a little thin, it is with anxiety about prospects yet uncertain.
You tremble and become flushed whenever Miss Oliver enters the schoolroom.
You are original and not timid. There is something brave in your spirit, as well as penetrating in your eye. But you give me a larger allowance of sympathy than I have a just claim to. When I colour and shake before Miss Oliver, I do not pity myself. I scorn the weakness. Know me to be what I am, a cold, hard man. Oh, you smile. Let me tell you that I watch your career with interest, because I consider you a specimen of a diligent, orderly, energetic woman. Not because I am deeply compassionate of what you have gone through or what you still suffer.
I see. Well, Mr. Rivers, to return to my question, may I draw for you a...
I will look once more at the portrait. Yes. Yes, she is lovely. She is well named, the Rose of the World, indeed.
And may I not paint one like it for you?
Oh. Cui bono? No, no. Why, what is this?
That is merely a sheet of paper on which I rest my hand in painting, to prevent the cardboard from being sullied.
Indeed.
Why do you look at me so?
I think I will keep this part of the sheet.
Mr. Rivers, what's the matter?
Nothing. Nothing in the world.
And why do you look
good
at me
afternoon.
Like...
Good
Mr. Rivers, were any ill news? Has anything occurred that you should venture out on such a night?
No. How very easily alarmed you are, though. I have had hard work to get here. One drift took me up to the waist.
But why are you come?
Rather an inhospitable question to put to a visitor.
Oh.
But since you ask it, I answer simply to have a little talk with you.
Well? Have you heard from Diana and Mary lately?
Not since the letter I showed you a week ago.
Oh. Mr. Oliver means to give the whole school a treat at Christmas.
Yes, I know.
Was it your suggestion?
No.
Whose then?
His daughter's, I think.
Oh, it is like her. She is so good-natured.
Yes. Draw a little nearer the fire.
Very well.
I must tell you that since yesterday, I have experienced the excitement of a person to whom a tale has been half told and who is impatient to hear the sequel. It is but fair to warn you that the story may sound somewhat hackneyed in your ears. 19 years ago, an orphan was reared by an aunt-in-law, Mrs. Reed of Gateshead.
Sure.
Ah, you start. Did you hear a noise? Shall I continue?
In the fourth part of Jane Eyre, adapted by Barbara Cooper from a novel by Charlotte Bronte, Jane Eyre was played by Meg Wynne Owen, Mr. Rochester by Patrick Allen, and St. John Rivers by John Rye. Diana Rivers, Patricia Leventon, Mary Rivers, Kate Binchy, Hannah Ella Milne, Rosamond Oliver, Jane Knowles, coachman William Edel, shopkeeper Eva Stewart, housekeeper Betty Bascom. The episode was produced by Betty Davis.